This is Jock Talk, an intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing. Presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who touched Derby, 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Bradley come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano.
A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I am retired jockey Christina McManigal. I would like to thank everyone joining us throughout North America on Sirius 220, XM 206, as well as to those listening on our website at horseracingradio.net. A portion of the proceeds from this show go to benefit the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF is a great organization that helps permanently disabled riders. If you feel like helping, please go to pdjf.org and donate. Now, I am very excited about our guest tonight, a legend in racing. He's shattered so many records. A rider I looked up to during my career, although I was usually looking up to him from behind. He was hard to catch on the lead. After all, he's crossed the wire in front 5,208 times. I'm very happy to introduce to you jockey Tony Black. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Christine. Yeah, it's been quite a few years since I sat next to you in the starting gate. But when you had your introduction, I heard you say you're a retired jock.
Yes, Tony.
I'm not sure if jocks ever retire. They might retire from the afternoon racing, but they don't retire and get off the racetrack. I think, you know, when we choose the racetrack as a profession, it's in the early, in our early years. And then all of a sudden, we love it so much, the track chooses us, and we can't walk away from it. And that's just where I'm at right now.
I couldn't agree with you more, Tony, and that's why I'm here. That's why you're here. And actually, you are also not only accomplished in the saddle, but you are a seasoned radio professional, from what I hear. So tell us about that.
I've been fortunate enough to make contact with some people in about 10, 12 years ago. J.J. Gracie started a racing program with Steve Bick, and then Steve Bick wound up taking it over, and I've been on his show for the last, I guess he's been doing it 12 years. So I've been on his show once a week for the last 12 years. And then there's another radio show on Saturday. It's Boston Radio with Billy the Greek. And I do his show every Saturday for 30, 40 minutes. And we have a lot of fun, and you'd be surprised how many people you get to meet, that I've either heard their names and never rode for them, or owners, trainers, breeders. Ken Ramsey's been on Billy the Greek's show. You name a trainer, and we've had them on. Jerry Hollendorfer, his assistant trainer, and Steve Bick, he has a multitude of trainers and owners that he deals with and handicappers on a weekly basis. It's really interesting. And in fact, Gary Stevens was just on Steve Bick's show yesterday. Richard Migliore was on it this morning. And it's a lot of fun doing radio.
It is a lot of fun. I completely agree with you, Tony, and it's great to have you here. And how we usually do these shows, we kind of start from the beginning, and you can give us an introduction of how you got involved in the sport. And you were born in Mount Holly, New Jersey, and you've kind of stayed around that area. And tell us about how it was growing up there.
Well, I was born in Mount Holly, and I lived on a farm that my uncle owned in Marlton, New Jersey. He owned a 180-acre boarding and training center, and that's where I lived the first 9 years of my life. My uncle was Sam Bonitas. He rode for close to 20 years, and he was, after he retired in '67, he was an official up to about 5 years ago at a on the Jersey circuit. So Sample Midas introduced my family to the racing game. Like I said, he started riding in 1948. I wasn't born until 51, but he rode till 67, which seems like an eternity of years ago. But, you know, I started riding in 1970. I must have been 8 or 9 years old. Now, I started riding in 1970 at Liberty Bell Racetrack. It was June 15th in 1970. And I'll tell you why I'm telling you this story. I was under contract to a trainer, Charlie Coco. And in those days, you rubbed horses, you galloped horses, you walked them, you did everything. So this one horse that he said he would put me on and make it my first mount was a horse that I rode that succumbed to a tendon injury the year before. I mean, it was a horse that I had ran as a groom the year before, and I'd been galloping horses. So he let me rub this horse and gallop about 15 horses in the barn, catch stalls, do everything that a young jock does, learning to be a young jock. Well, on June 15th, he entered this horse, and he said he'd put me on him. So I didn't go to my high school graduation, which was on the same day. And I went and I rode this horse. Well, you know, he was a zillion to one, and they had no great expectations for him. Well, don't you know, it was my first mount that I ever rode, and the horse won. He paid $106.40. And that's how I started my riding career. And in those days, you never won your first race. They used to make you ride 5, 10, 20, 50 horses before they ever put you on a live one. You know, well, that week I rode 8 horses and 5 of them won. So I started my bug the first week that I started riding. Now, this is why I'm telling you this story. You never can plan on winning your first race. But I did. Maybe it was just a lucky accident, but he won. But I would like to win my last race and make it like a career with bookends, first and last race winners. And that's a personal goal. And in that personal goal, I want to win 2 more races to end on an even number. I like even numbers. So I'm like you said, I'm at 5208. Well, I have to ride 2 more winners to be 5210, and my last one I can plan on making that one a winner. You know, because if I'm on 1 or 2 horses that day and that one wins, I just won't ride the next one if it's at 5210. So you can't plan winning your first race, but you can plan winning on your last race. And that is my personal goal. It probably doesn't mean a lot to people, but it means something to me.
Tony, you fast-forwarded through this. I was going to ask you that question if you were really retired, because if I remember right, you initially said you were going to retire after 5,200 winners even. And, well, we see that that didn't happen. So now we're going for 5,210. That's...
Yeah, I'll tell you why it didn't happen. And it probably should have. It was a horse that my son owned was 5,200 winners, a horse called Smart Tory. And then, of course, I hadn't ridden for quite a few months, and a friend of mine calls me to ride a few horses. He says, oh, come on, Tony, just get on these horses for me. You're getting on horses in the morning. Just ride a couple horses for me. And then another trainer gets in touch with me. Trainer's name is Mike Arrow, and he had a really nice filly. This was in 2014, a horse called Winning Image. Mm-hmm. He says, you'll fit this horse to a T. She's a speed horse. She's running in a few stake races. I want you to go ride her. So I says, all right, Mike. I thought he was going to run her at Parks. Mm-hmm. Well, he enters her at Laurel. I says, Mike, I can't go ride. I said, I have trouble finding the jocks room at Parks. You mean I'm going to go ride, take a drive 2.5 hours to Laurel to go ride your horse? He says, oh, please, Tony, the owner's really expecting you. Well, it was 100,000, and I went down there and rode her, kind of like reluctantly drove down there to ride her. Don't you know she won? And that was 100,000. Then he puts her in, of course, a stake at Pimlico. I think it was another 100,000, and she won. Then he puts her in another race. I think it was the day before the Preakness. She was third in the race, I believe. And then she finally ran in a stake of 75,000 at Parks, and I won on her again. And then they ran her one more time and retired her, and she went to She was sold and then went to the breeding shed. If you look her up, her name's Winning Image. So I kind of got tricked into riding those last few winners, which put me at 5208. And then I said, well, I want to end on, like I said, another even number, and let's do it on 10. It'll be 5210, and it's written in stone, Christine. Well, that will be it, 5210.
Well, there we go, folks. He's currently accepting rides, so you can give out your contact information later, Tony. I remember that filly, Winning Image, and she was a speed demon. I want to talk about what I mentioned in the introduction. Very few jockeys were ever able to pass you when you were on the lead, and it was just incredible. Those of you who are familiar with Tony Black's riding style, you were just unbeatable on the lead. And describe to our listeners why that was, how that came to be, and your strategy when you were in front.
Well, of course, when you're in front, you want to do it as easy as possible. You might have to use your horse very early, leaving the gate, and then you want to get them to relax. And the skill in getting them to relax is kind of tricky at times, because it's like getting them in gear and then get them out of gear. And I'll tell you, I really attribute, and this is what I really attribute it to, learning how to relax horses on the lead is very important. And I'll tell you what was my best teacher in learning how to relax horses on the lead. And I've made this statement before in social media and different other venues. I learned by watching a lot of the women jockeys, which started riding in the 70s, ride horses with a light touch and finesse. And a lot of the women impressed me then, even though they were breaking into a profession that was dominated by males. The women riders, of course, some of them not having as maybe as much muscle as some of the men. And some of them did, so I don't want to say all of them didn't. But they had better hands than so many than I had. Maybe there were a lot of male riders that had good hands on horses. I had those hard hands. You know, I was one of those riders when I started out. I'll reach and grab them. I'll crank them down, and I'll make them do what I want them to do. And that's how I started riding. But the more I watched some of the women ride, you saw them come out there. They didn't fight with them. They got along with them. At times, they actually looped the reins and dropped their head, and all of a sudden, you saw these horses relaxing and not getting anxious and not pulling on them, and they were easier to handle and manage. And that's when, in the old days, you say, you got good hands on a horse or you got bad hands on a horse. When I started out, I think I had bad hands on a horse. When I learned to have a gentler, kinder touch, a light hands on a horse's neck, that's when I got to be a better rider. And then I got to be a better rider on the lead. Now, some of the old-time riders used to tell me that were in the business a while, never get categorized as a front-end rider, you'll limit your business. Never get categorized as a come-from-behind rider, you'll limit your business. Well, some way or another, I got categorized because I rode a lot of speed horses, and they happened to win, who knows, as a speed rider. And then, of course, it snowballed, and then I got the opportunity to ride many good speed horses. I can name some Eclipse Award winners that I rode. I rode My Juliet, Strictly Speed, Dave's Friend, Strictly Speed. Well, they both won the Eclipse Award. Rode What a Summer, speed horse. Danny Dotsy, some really nice speed horses. And, of course, when you ride a lot of good speed horses, all of a sudden you get put in that category as a speed rider. And in my early part of my career, there were some really exceptional speed riders. One of them, of course, you'll know the name, Walter Blum.
Oh, yeah.
He was a great speed rider. And one of his strongest suits was he could get a horse to break real good. He could get him to show speed early, get him to relax, and then put him back in gear in the later stages of the race. And I guess that's what I learned to do from a lot of the girl riders they taught me. And, of course, Walter Blum. I have to attribute some of it to him.
That's fascinating, Tony. I've never heard you say that about the women riders. And like you said, when you're dealing with a 1,000-pound animal and we're all the same weight, of course, women and men naturally are built differently, but there is so much finesse and just coaxing the horse into listening to what you're trying to tell them to do. And that's fascinating. I had never heard you say that. And, of course, you mentioned the wonderful, accomplished speed horses you rode, and I find that good horses teach you when you're especially starting out, and obviously you maybe got categorized as a good speed rider, but hey, you were a very good speed rider. Like I said, I remember many a race I could not get past you. It was
You know what? It's a category that I was, maybe personally, I was reluctant to be put into, but I sure capitalized on it once I got put into that category, and I enjoyed riding all types of horses in all categories. And like I said, I was really fortunate to get some world-class horses that were speed horses. Like I said, Dave Sren, what a nice sprinter he was. Candy Eclair, horses like that. My Juliet was one of the horses that stood out in my mind. I'll never forget her. And when it comes to riding those horses, at times, you, of course, being a rider that's in the area with that horse or stable at the same track, you know, the horse is stable at the track you're riding at, people ask you to get on horses, and they'll say, and I'll never forget, they used to ask me, oh, come on over and get on my Juliet. She's just going to gallop, but just come get on her. And I'd go over there and get on her, and I could barely gallop her. And when I'd ride her in the afternoon, she was like push button. You could break her, put her to sleep, put her on the bit. She was just so easy to ride her. Could I gallop her in the morning? No. But could I ride them in the afternoon? Yeah. It's funny how that happens. And then you'd see somebody that worked with her and got on her that was just an exercise person that had good hands and had a good rapport with the horse. I don't know if you remember the one valet at Parks, well, it was Philadelphia Park or Keystone at the time when you were there. It was Philadelphia Park, I think. Russian, the valet.
Yes.
He could gallop my Juliet, and I couldn't gallop her a quarter mile without having her run off. Yet I could ride her in the afternoon, and she was a sweetheart.
Wow.
So it's funny how you get along with horses, and they all have different personalities.
Absolutely.
But being, just like I said, fortunate to get on some of the good ones.
Well, and you mentioned My Juliet, and going into the 1976 Vosburgh Stakes, she was undefeated, and you were actually going against the Derby and Belmont winner, Bold Forbes. Why don't you tell us about that race, Tony?
That was an exciting race. Of course, they had hopes that she could get an Eclipse Award, and then not too long before she came back on her campaign after the vagrancy, she'd gotten operated on, and they put a screw in her cannonbone, I believe, her ankle. We used to call her the Bionic Billy because she had a screw in her one leg. And the only reason I wound up getting the mount, I think Georgie Velasquez was supposed to ride her, but Jean Euster asked me to work her in the morning before she ever started running again after the operation. And, you know, they were very concerned that she was going to maybe not hold up. They didn't know. And he knew I would work her and use good judgment. So I worked her. And Georgie was supposed to come ride her, but she was only running in an allowance race at Keystone. So Gene said, listen, well, look, Georgie can't take off in New York, so you can ride her today, but you're not going to ride her in any of the stakes. So they ran her in the allowance race, and she just won for fun and beat some nice fillies, you know, and it was just a pleasure to get a chance to ride her one time. The next time she was in was a stake race. I'm not sure if it was either Monmouth, Delaware, or Philly. I'm not even sure. I don't have the chart in front of me. And Georgie couldn't ride her. He was riding some nice horses in New York that weekend, and he couldn't come ride her. So they said, guess what, Tony? You're going to get a chance to ride her one more time. And she won the stake race. So I said, boy, what a great opportunity this was. I don't care if I ever ride her again, but I got a chance to ride a really nice horse. Well, the next time they had her in, Georgie couldn't ride her again in a stake race. I was named on her that next time. And don't you know I won that one.
Wow.
After I won that one, they says, you know what? Georgie's got too much business. You can keep the mount. The owner, George Weasel, told me, Georgie Velasquez doesn't have to ride her. You can keep the mount. You ride her. And I stayed on her to the end of her career, and I wound up winning I think 10 or 11 races on her. I won on her going 3/4 of a mile, 7/8 of a mile, and even a mile and an eighth I won on her. I won the Michigan mile and an eighth on her. But the big thrill was the race you're talking about, the Vosburgh, because we had the Derby and Belmont winner, Bo Forbes, in there. And when we're walking into the starting gate, Angel Cordero looks over at me. And I'm just a kid that's been riding 5 or 6 years, and this is the great Angel Cordero. And I always kid him about this when I see it. He says, "Keep on straight leaving here, boy. Just don't bother me." And that was his last words to me as to walking into the gate. Well, she kept real straight leaving there. She left there running, and I think he was on the outside of me. I kind of parked him out. You know how you do. You herd horses out. You herd them in a little bit. And we did that little number. And coming around the last turn, I think I parked him out a little bit. And I wound up winning the race. Well, he claimed foul.
Really?
But he didn't. He claimed foul on me. But then he forgot leaving the gate. The only one that didn't stay straight was him. And he bothered a horse called It's Freezing leaving the gate. Now, he finished second. He claimed foul against me, and they took him down and placed him third. And I think they put up a horse named It's Freezing at Eddie Maple Grove. So it was kind of a funny story. You know, he claimed foul. They took him down. That was, and it was, and I was holding my breath during the objection because, you know, you're riding aggressively. You know what it is. You're getting out there. You're pulling all the stops out. This was my opportunity to win a big race, the Vosburgh, and it also was the opportunity for My Juliet possibly to become the Eclipse Award-winning Sprinter of the Year, and that's the race that made her the Eclipse Award-winning Sprinter of the Year. And how many opportunities you get in riding a Keystone or Philadelphia Bar to ride an Eclipse Award winner. I've been fortunate. I've had a few opportunities.
Yes, you have, Tony. And I can't imagine the nerves you must have been feeling when the objection sign starts flashing, and not that you thought you were coming down, but still just to have that risk of that happening. And then poor Angel Cordero ends up with the short end of the stick there. How about that, your relationship with Angel? Did it improve after that?
Yeah, we've had a mutual respect for each other. You know, when you're an aggressive rider, you're going to do things to each other, and it's not in, you're not taking names and saying, "I'm looking for you." It's just you're aggressive, and riders sometimes will run up in the wrong spot. I'll run up in the wrong spot. It's not an intentional act. It's just being an aggressive rider. You know, you ride tight and you try to win races, and sometimes you cross the line, and hopefully you don't cross the line and ever drop anybody, which, knock on wood, I can say I never I might have crossed the line and got my number taken down, but I've never dropped a rider. And, you know, when you ride tight, you think sometimes that's an accomplishment. You know, you don't want to get dropped, but you definitely don't want to drop somebody. And I've been a rider that never had the reputation of being sometimes easy to ride with, but I've never been a careless, dangerous rider.
Jockey Tony Black joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tony, we only have a few minutes before our break, but talk about that, the feeling in the jocks room. That is the only kind of place where the competitors all gather back together in the same room. And tensions have to get high sometimes, as I know and you know, but describe that a little bit, the relationships that develop in the jocks room.
Well, you know, it is a strange environment at times, and you better be real flexible and able to give it out and able to take it. That's the best way I can put it. You know, you wouldn't put, in this area, you wouldn't put the Eagles, the Philadelphia Eagles and the Dallas Cowboys in the same locker room. But, and that's the way I look at it. Sometimes, you know, we're great competitors, but we have to go back and rub elbows. And then once in a while, you know, somebody's not going to like you, you're not going to like them, but you learn to get along. It is an unusual setting. You know, here you are, you're competing against each other. You make a better living than you win than when you're second, third, or fourth, or just getting around there. So sometimes you're riding aggressively against each other. A lot of, well, not sometimes, you know, all the time you're riding out there, you're trying to do your best and you're aggressive and riding against each other. And here you come back and you have to interact and you you better be able to adjust to different personalities. And once in a while, you're going to get somebody that just doesn't like you, or you guys are, you know, like oil and water. But they just don't mix. But if you want to last, you better learn to mix. It's a tough environment. But being a professional, you learn how to handle it. And, you know, you've been in there. The thing about the girls' jocks rooms, usually they're a lot smaller than the men's jocks rooms. So you girls, you really had a tough time, I can imagine. I mean, it's not... At least in the men's jocks room, they're usually a lot bigger. You can go in the rec room, or you can go in the movie room, or you can go in the lunch room or the locker room and get away from each other if you have to, which most of the time you don't. But I guess with the girls, I know the jocks rooms that I've seen of theirs, hey, you're almost sitting next to each other, whether you want to. They're usually smaller and not as accommodating as the male. A jocks room. I guess that can present some problems, but you know how to handle them, being a true professional.
You're exactly right, Tony. It's awfully close quarters there in the girls' room. You better get along or go outside or something. But and at the same time, of course, on the track, you do have to look out for each other, and it is kind of a family-type setting, I guess, where maybe you don't always get along, but you don't want to see anyone get hurt, of course. But how about, Tony, in the jocks room, who kind of took you under their wing when you first started out?
That's a good question. I'm going to name a rider that maybe people don't even remember, but he took me under his wing. His name was Chris Rogers. He was a Canadian rider that would come south in the winter time when Canada would close. He was a rider that had ridden through different areas of the country, but I think he was originally from Canada. And when I was in Liberty Bell, he took me aside one day, and we were in the same corner. And a lot of times the old riders, if you were a good, nice enough kid that would listen, they would take you under their wing. And he took me under his wing. I'll never forget the first time he said, "Hey, kid." He used to call everybody, you know, all the young riders, "Hey, kid." And he said, "Hey, kid, I'm going to teach you how to sit on a horse." He says, "Because you got good head, but you look terrible." And he gave me a lesson in sitting on a horse and getting a seat that looked was more aerodynamic, more polished, made you look firmer. It made you look better and easier to sell as an apprentice rider to trainers. And he used to say, put your chest up against your knees, and that's the way you keep it. Ride. And he'd say, "Don't ride short." And in those days, jocks were starting to jack their irons up in the 70s, and riding shorter and shorter. And he was an old rider. He rode like Hardtack and Arcaro and those guys. You know, they used to ride long. And he'd say, "Put your knee at a right angle. Put your chest up against your knee and stay in that position." He said, "Eventually, your legs will get fitter. You'll get stronger. And that'll be the only position you want to be in on a horse's back. You'll be like I forget how you say it, a cheap suitcase, fold up like a cheap suitcase," mm-hmm. or something like that, he'd say. And that's the way I learned to sit on a horse. And eventually, when you raised your chest up off of your knees, you felt uncomfortable. But when you first started out, or I started out, I would raise my chest up off my knees to try to save my legs and save my strength. Well, when I finally learned to keep my chest up against my knees and really fold up on a horse, it got to be the only way I could sit on a horse, and you'd sit on that way from start to finish. And that was Chris Rogers. Then, of course, like I said, I mentioned riders like Walter Blum. They were old riders at the time, and I'd watch them ride and how they would sit in the starting gate and how comfortable they would be and how loose they would be on a horse, you know, comfortably loose. Not tight and not short reins and not riding real short. And, you know, you rode with me enough, Christine. I never rode real short, did I? In fact, at times there were people who said, "Boy, you really ride long for short legs." But I always felt comfortable on a horse, and I always thought I looked pretty good on a horse.
We'll continue our visit with jockey Tony Black after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit Tito'sVodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Get ready for the third annual Jockeys and Jeans charity event to benefit the PDJF coming to Gulfstream Park on Sunday, February 28th. Last year, Jockeys and Jeans raised more than $200,000 to benefit permanently disabled riders, and you can help make this year's event even bigger. Meet and mingle with an all-star cast of jockeys, including Lafitte Pinkai Jr., Georgie Velasquez, Pat Day, Randy Romero, and many more. Tickets go on sale at the beginning of January, and donations and sponsorship can be purchased starting December 7th. For more information, visit jockeysandjeans.com. Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Pena, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network, but the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
Good evening, everyone. This is Corey Johnson with the weekly Jockey Talk 360 update. On Saturday at Gulfstream Park, the star of the show was jockey Joel Rosario. The 31-year-old reinsman won five races, including two stakes races, and was named the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week. One thing I want you to keep an eye on, I've seen Joel Rosario get hot in the past, and he can just dominate even a very competitive rider group like Gulfstream Park. So keep an eye on Joel Rosario. When he finds his stride, he can be unbeatable. Another jockey who is definitely hot is Santiago Gonzalez. He is now the leading rider at Santa Anita with 10 wins and 41 mounts. If you remember, we've been talking about the riding prowess of Santiago Gonzalez the entire fall. He's just been putting great rides on horses over and over. And how about Sunday's ride aboard Prize Exhibit in the Monrovia Stakes? Gonzalez came down the hill on this horse, first time she'd ever been going 6.5 at Santa Anita, and won the race by a nose. Santiago Gonzalez, one of the hottest riders in the country, and always give his mounts an extra look at Santa Anita. Now, whether you're by a warm fire or on a beach in Florida, I've got a great read for you. Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, is the compilation of 100 interviews, many with Hall of Fame jockeys, by authors Bob Fortas and Gary West. It gives some great stories, like Randy Romero aboard Personal Ensign in the 1988 Breeders' Cup Classic. Or how about Gary Stevens' look in the 2013 Preakness aboard Oxbow? You can order Ride to Win, an inside look at the jockey's craft, by going to jockeytalk360.com. It's $20 plus shipping and handling. And like this show, a portion of the proceeds goes to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. This is Corey Johnson reporting for Jockey Talk 360.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Christina McManigal here. I am joined tonight by jockey Tony Black. And Tony, before we cut to commercial break, we were talking about Chris Rogers and what he taught you, and how you rode longer than most riders, especially during the time I rode. Most people jack their irons up so short, and you, I always noticed, rode very long, and you would get down so close to the horse. It had to be so aerodynamic, and they do say that the longer you ride, the longer you ride, which is obviously true, given that, how old are you, Tony, 64?
I'm 64. I started riding in 1970. So I guess it does hold true, the longer you ride, the longer you ride. It's 45 years ago that I rode my first race, so.
Wow.
And then all the years that I rode long, learning to gallop horses. I guess I started galloping horses in 68.
That's incredible, Tony. And I want to share a fun fact that I just looked up. You've had 33,933 starts, and that's just in the afternoon. That's not in the morning, which I'm sure that number just absolutely quadruples, multiplies. I mean, it's ridiculous how many horses you've sat on. And just to put that into perspective, the circumference of the Earth is 24,000 miles. So you've gone around the Earth, you know, at least a time or two. So that's pretty mind-boggling to think about, Tony. And you've seen so much. You've been around the Mid-Atlantic region for so long. And I would like to talk with you about Garden State and a track that I never had the privilege of going to, but tell us about Garden State, and you were there the day that it went up in flames.
Yeah, I was a leading rider at that meet, and I think Jimmy Edwards was second to me. I think I was like 10, 12 in front, leading rider. Looked like I had a heck of a shot of being leading rider in New Jersey that year, even though I was going to go back to Pennsylvania after the Garden State meet. I'll never forget it. I won on a horse called First Brisk. I think that was the last horse I won on there that day that the place caught fire, and they paid off at the track. I rode the next race with Rick Wilson, who won the race, on a horse called Duty Roster. Here I can't remember what I ate for dinner last night, but I can remember horses' names from years and years ago, because it was 1977 when it burned down. And Duty Roster, they didn't pay off at the racetrack. They paid off at the Cherry Hill Inn the next day. We're galloping back, and we see smoke billowing from the grandstand or clubhouse, you know, from the building. And I'm thinking, hey, we're going to get out of here early today. We'll go home early today. Must have fire in the kitchen or something. Well, we never thought the place was going to burn to the ground, but it did, and it was just a sad sight. We wound up leaving the jocks room through the back window. The back window, by the time we went back to the jocks room in the hallway and up to the second or third floor, whatever it was, I think it was third floor jocks room, second floor, whatever, you couldn't get back through that hallway to get out of the jocks room. And then we realized this place is going to burn. And it had the history of being mostly a wooden building with very little modern steel construction, which was the newest construction. I think it was built in 48 or whatever it was built, whatever year. They built everything out of wood, the main beams, everything were wood. That place went up like a tinderbox. We left through the back window of the jocks room, and it was just lucky that somebody remembered there was a jock sleeping in the sleeping room, and his name was Bobby Stobel. He was a racing official for many years, I think, in the in Midwest or Texas. But somebody went and woke him up. Well, before we left the jocks room and went and jumped down to the porch roof, to the paddock, to the next story, and to the ground, we threw all our tack out the window, and we put it over in the commission building, which was across to the paddock. Well, we thought at least we saved our tack. This place is gone. Well, that building caught on fire, too, because that fire was so intense from the wood construction. It was just such a sad sight to see that old track burn to the ground. And, of course, you know, I can say I rode there when it burned down. I rode there when they rebuilt it. And I rode there when they tore it down. And now I do my grocery shopping there at Wegmans, and I wonder where the wire was. There's not there's one small remnant left of the racetrack, and it's a clubhouse entrance on Route 70. It's a little brick building, and I hope they restore that little brick building just to have it as a landmark of where Garden State was. But now it's Home Depot, it's Wegmans, it's the Christmas tree store, it's Best Buy, and it's a multitude of condominiums. And, you know, Christine, it's sad to see racetracks close down. And I'm thinking all the years I rode, and, you know, you look, Bowie Racetrack. Bowie was it's a training center now, but, you know, I won some major races there. I won the John B. Campbell there, which is one of Merlin's major races. You know, not as big, of course, Preakness, but it's a major race. And then you see racetracks like Marlboro, that close. You see DRC, I won the Michigan Mile there, that close. It's sad to see these racetracks close, you know, Garden State, you know, I go past it, and I always wonder where the wire was. But, you know, that's the change in the game. The game has changed, and it's there are different racetracks that have survived, some haven't survived. You see racetracks cutting days. You see racetracks incorporating their business with casinos. Some of the racetracks thrive for a while. Sometimes the racetracks even incorporated with casinos, they seem to limit the racing and they promote the casino. You know, a refreshing part of this sight to see in this sport is Merlin Racing. And I just read some articles where their handle's up. The casino is a separate entity from the racetrack, but the racetrack puts on a great show. I just saw an article at Sal Sinatra was quoted in, and it looks like they're turning the business around in Maryland, and they're bigger fields, handles up. They've renovated their facility at Laurel, and of course, Maryland's got the Preakness. What else do you want in racing? Derby, Preakness, and Belmont. Merlin's got the Preakness. And it looks like they're putting on one hell of a show in Merlin, and I really commend them. It's refreshing to see that happen in racing, because you certainly don't want to see racing go by the wayside. It's a great sport, the beautiful animals, and look, it's the combination of two athletes, jockey and horse. And it's a great sport. It's beautiful.
It is a beautiful thing, Tony, and it is sad to see so much change happening. But like you said, with Maryland, there is hope. There is hope. It is sad to see those racetracks with so much history, however, like you mentioned, no longer exist. But you mentioned the Preakness. Tony, you actually rode in the Preakness along with two derbies. Tell us about those.
Oh, yeah. I rode in the Preakness, and I'll never forget it. You know, at the time, it didn't seem too important because the great Secretariat was in just dominating the sport at the time. He won the Derby, and he went to the Preakness, and I rode a long shot in the Preakness. But if I remember correctly, Sham and Secretariat were banging heads at the time, and Sham was the only hope to beat Secretariat, or was hoping to beat Secretariat. And I think Sham was the, what do you think? I know I was right in between Sham and Secretariat. Whatever it was, 2-3-4 or 1-2-3, Sham was either the 1 or the 2, Secretariat was the 3. But this is what I really remember about the Preakness. And, you know, Secretariat was a gorgeous, big red horse. But I remember the Preakness like this. The further we went, the smaller Secretariat got. Because he just kept getting further away from me. But now thinking back to it many years, you know, after riding it in 1973, now it seems more important than it did at the time. And it's a fond memory.
It should be, Tony. What an experience. How many people can say that they've been in a race with Secretariat? That's amazing. That's amazing.
And sat right next to him.
Wow.
I was right in between Sham and Secretariat. I'm pretty sure if you look it up, I was right in between Sham and Secretariat. And it was only a 6 or 7 or 7 horse field, I believe. You know, now you see these classic races with bigger fields. But, you know, it was a thrill. And like you said, I had the opportunity to ride in two derbies. You know, and that's a thrill. You know, I rode in the 81 Derby and Pleasant Colony won it. And it was a 19 or 20 horse field. And I finished fourth. That was a thrill. Maybe it didn't seem so important at the time, but when I look back to it, you think, here's a little guy that's coming out of Keystone or Philadelphia Park, wherever it was. I guess it was still Keystone. I'm not sure. And getting the opportunity to ride in a major classic race, you know, like the Derby. And then in 96, I got a chance to ride in it again. But finished way back, and Jerry Bailey won it on Grindstone. But it was a thrill. I took my two boys down there and my wife, and we had a 4 or 5 days of Derby festivities. It was a memory. And I even have a picture from the jocks room where I took my boys up in the jocks room, and there was a good old athlete that was making a comeback. His name was George Foreman. And the boxer, and he took a picture with my boys, and the photographer sent me the picture when I got home of George Foreman and my two boys. And I look back, and they were only like 12 or 13 years, 14 years old at the time, but it's a great memory. So this business has provided me with some really tremendous memories of a lifetime.
I would say so, Tony. Incredible memories you have. Like I said, we need much more time than 1 hour to talk about them all. And you mentioned your sons. Tell us about your family. You have two older sons and two younger children as well, I believe.
Yeah, I have a 35-year-old, a 33-year-old. Tony's the oldest, and then my next is 33 years old. It's Mike. They're not really on the racetrack. My older son does get the you throw out of owning a horse here or there, and he's even bred a mare here or there, but he doesn't make his living at the racetrack. He just spends some money at the racetrack, but he's in other businesses. And my other son, he's a banker, so he's never going to come to the racetrack. He says, we crunch the numbers, they don't add up. But he's in banking. And then I have, went from 35, 33, and I have a 10-year-old daughter, and a 7-year-old, an 8-year-old, in fact, he just turned 8, December the 19th. My daughter, she's just a great little girl. She's physically, mentally disabled, but she's taught me a lot. She's probably made me a better person, because you don't take things for granted. When you have a child that's disabled, you know, all of a sudden you don't take it for granted that all your other children are, and you start valuing the things that you have, not what you want, but what you have. And like I say, she's taught me a lot. She's a beautiful little girl. She's 10 years old. At the time we had her, you know, she was diagnosed early as mentally disabled. They said she'd never walk and, you know, and all these things she'd never do. And guess what? She walks. And she does a lot of things that she wasn't supposed to be able to do, but she's just a fighter. I don't know where she gets that from, but she's a fighter. And then I got a little boy, 8 years old, and he's one of the best athletes in town. With every sport he goes out for, he excels. He plays soccer, he excels. He plays baseball, he excels. He wrestles. In fact, I'm an assistant coach on the wrestling, the Junior Athletic Association wrestling team. And, flag football, you name a sport, he follows it, and then he plays it. And he's a good little athlete. He keeps telling me, I'm not going to be a jockey, Dad. I'm going to be an NFL player. Well, at this point, that might be a stretch. He looks like he's only going to be a little bit bigger than maybe me. But we'll see. But he's a good little athlete, and he does really well in school. But they all, you know, all of them do like the racetrack. And but like I said, my youngest son, Pete, he loves the racetrack.
Well, Tony, you're what, 4'11", if I remember right?
Yeah, I'm 4'11", and I used to be 4'11 and three quarters, but you know, as you get older, you might shrink a little bit. I'm probably just 4'11", but what's the difference if you're 4'11 or 5 foot? You know, it's just a number.
Well, it worked out well for you, Tony. And you also were a champion high school wrestler when you were younger, and I mean, it's very understandable that your youngest son might not be able to make the NFL, but you never know. Maybe he will change his mind about becoming a rider. But what a beautiful thing about your daughter. That's so wonderful to hear. And I want to touch on another experience that had to have changed you. And you always mention that your career is really kind of broken into two different halves. And we're going to talk about the 1980s when you went through kind of a rough time.
I was fortunate enough to have two 20-year careers. When I first started riding in 70, my nose was to the grindstone for 9, 10 years, 11 years. And then I thought I started missing something. And maybe it was, you think you're missing something because you're working so hard. By the end of the 80s, there was a gradual decline from about 81 to 90. And it was because of drugs, cocaine, alcohol, abuse. It was a gradual decline, but by 1990, it was not only could no one be able to stand me, I couldn't stand myself. So I went through a really bad period of 8 or 9 years. It was, I said gradual decline until I finally hit bottom. And in December 15th of 1990, I had had enough, and I went into rehab. I went into Father Martin's Ashley in Havity Grass, Maryland. And, Havity Grass, that even used to be a racetrack in Maryland. I went down there, and I thought, if I'm ever going to get my life straight, I got one opportunity to do it, and it's now. And I've been very fortunate through what they taught me, Father Martin's Ashley, and, and then figuring things out and straightening my act up. I've been sober since December 15th, 1990. And I was fortunate enough to have a second 20-year career. Because it was really around 2012 when I, just about ended being an everyday jockey. But in that second 20-year career, I had the opportunity to ride a lot of winners and ride some nice horses. And then I had the opportunity to meet Kylie, my wife now, Kylie Waters, and that's who I've had my second two children with, Madison and Pete. So getting sober was a turning point. I either could have ended up a total derelict and just a has-been, whatever, never was a has-been on the backside, maybe walking hops, or turn the corner and get sober and get back to reality and straighten my act up. And I was very fortunate. I had good support of friends and my family. My father helped me get into a rehab in Maryland. I was, 39 years old when I straightened up. And like I said, I've been fortunate enough to stay sober since then. And it's given me so much. So I'm really... When you get sober, you have to show gratitude or be grateful. I am very grateful because of December 15th, 1990, I decided not to be a bum.
Jockey Tony Black joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. What a fantastic story, Tony. And that is something we see not just jockeys, but many professional athletes go through and deal with, and that temptation of drugs and alcohol whenever so much money is given to young people and they don't know what to do with it and they get in the wrong scene. And something else that not just many jockeys deal with, but every jockey deals with is injuries. And so tell us, Tony, I'm curious to hear the list of bones you've broken during your career.
Well, I've got three titanium plates, one in my arm, one in my collarbone, and 13 screws and a titanium plate in my right shoulder. I broke my L1, my L2, my T5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. I obliterated my T7. I'll never forget the day I broke my T5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. The doctor said, this is it. You'll never ride again. And Kylie was with me, and she started crying. And she saw them paychecks flying out the window. Now, that's cruel. That's not right. But anyway, and then I broke my arm, broke fingers, nose, all the little things, toes, broke my wrist. I had that operated on twice. Pelvis. You know what? You name a bone, probably broke something in the area of that bone, if you name it. But I've been fortunate. I think the one thing that's really, really, really riders can, if they ever think about, are severe head injuries. Never had one. Had some concussions and severe back injuries. My cousin, Sam Bolmides Jr., he's been paralyzed and he rode for 5, 6, 7 years and succumbed to an accident, and he's been paralyzed for 20-some years. But head injuries are the other thing that riders are really leery. You know, you really do have some fear of having a severe head injury. Now, I've had some severe concussions, and I was in a 5-horse spill where I was on the lead, and Stewie Elliott and I are heading head for the lead. My horse snapped both his legs off. Five of us fell. They went over top of me. That was the one when I broke my L1, my L2, my pelvis, my hand, and a severe concussion. About 10 days after I got out of the hospital, I'm sitting on my couch one day, and I didn't understand what a concussion was. And all of a sudden, the light went off, and I looked over at Kylie, and I said, "Hey, Kai, I'm all banged up like this because I was in a bad spill." And I swear, it was like all of a sudden, I knew I was banged up. I mean, when you break your pelvis, your hand, and your L1 and L2, you know you're banged up. But the light went off, and I realized the reality of why I was banged up finally hit me, and that's what the concussion was. That's why when I left the hospital, the doctor could say, "You've had a severe concussion. And you know, I just saw an article on concussions, and it was about, do you remember Gwen Jackson?
I read that article, and I do.
Yeah. You know, I could really relate to that. And you know, years ago, when you were a jockey and the way you worked at a racetrack, you know, in 70, I can remember in the early years of riding, you hit the ground, you got back up. If you didn't break something, you brushed yourself off, you went back to the jock's room, and the clerk of scale says, "You ride the next race, or what's going on?" "Yeah, I'm okay." Sometimes you never even saw a doctor. And this is how I could relate to that article about Gwen. You know, You never even saw a doctor. If you walked back or got an ambulance ride back to the jock's room and you were in one piece and there was nothing busted, if you wanted to ride the rest of the day, you rode. But I didn't realize really what a concussion was till that year, that was when I really got banged up. Like I said, it was a 5-horse spill. Until I had that severe concussion. But I've always wondered. I wonder how many concussions I really had after hitting the ground. Somebody sent me a race the other day from an interview from years ago, and it was about when they first put the Fontana fence in at Parks. And I remembered it because I remember having a horse hit it and unloading me on top of the Fontana rail. And I looked at it, and I said, "Man, I rode the next race." I could remember this still, and I rode the next race. But that's the way it was. But now, because of the NFL and because there's so many much more awareness of concussion, which is called CTE, that's chronic traumatic encephalopathy. And now there's a much greater awareness of that. And, you know, it's good for all athletes to be aware of what a concussion is. And I learned what it was the hard way.
Well, Tony, you're still sharp as a tack. And, folks, he's going to have two more winners, so keep an eye out. Be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. Thank you, Tony, for joining us. And for our producer, Lee Dalla Pina, I'm Christina McManigal. Thanks for listening.